Right now, we're taking a look at the latest news from the presidential campaign trail. Over the weekend, there's been more news about Republican nominee Donald Trump's federal income taxes, and Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton got a celebrity endorsement in a key swing state.
Abigail Tracy joins us now to tell us more. She's a staff news writer for Vanity Fair. She covers Silicon Valley, Wall Street, and Washington. Abigail, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, let's start off with the news about Donald Trump's taxes. Actually, getting into the background a little, he has declined to release tax returns out of custom with most presidential candidates. In effect, that's become a holy grail, hasn't it, for journalists and politics watchers to get any kind of morsel of evidence about what's on those.
Yes, it definitely has been. I think sort of refusing to release his tax returns, which has been a tradition of presidential candidates for decades now, has sort of invigorated journalists' hopes of finding something on him, or, you know, the reason why he is not choosing to release those tax returns.
And so here we are. One journalist in the New York Times goes, opens up her mail. There's a package with some information. What did we learn in this apparently leaked tax information from Donald Trump?
Well, so kind of what the tax document revealed was that in 1995, Donald Trump posted a $916 million loss, so just shy of $1 billion, which could have effectively, according to tax experts who spoke with the New York Times, allowed him to not pay income taxes for about the next 18 years. So, you know, you're looking at something like that, and that could be a reason why Donald Trump has chosen to this point not to release his tax returns.
And we're seeing the Clinton campaign and Democrats really running with this. Do you think they'll get a lot of mileage out of this, a little bit of Donald Trump's taxes that have been disclosed here?
I think so. I think what it does is it sort of lifts part of the veil of secrecy that's going on with the tax returns. And it does point to the fact that here is a guy who we know is incredibly wealthy, but has probably benefited from the tax code in a lot of ways. And I think this sort of shows, you know, if he wasn't paying income taxes for the nearly two decades that the New York Times suggested, you know, that is something that could affect voters and whether voters believe that if he is in office, he will no longer be giving wealthy people like himself tax breaks that benefit them and not, you know, middle class or working voters.
A lot of this, the tension over this tax is heated up in the first of three scheduled presidential debates. Let's give a little listen to that.
I will say this. We have a situation in this country that has to be taken care of. I will release my tax returns against my lawyer's wishes. When she releases her 33,000 emails that have been deleted.
So Donald Trump saying he had said can't release some audit. A lot of people said, well, there's no legal reason why you can't release tax returns while you're under an audit. Here he floated this idea anyway that if Hillary Clinton released, dug up some emails that had been deleted, he could, in fact, release it. Is that, do you think, going to be his line of counterattack as Democrats attack him over what we're seeing in his taxes?
I think so. I think, you know, in recent weeks, the Donald Trump campaign has done a very good job sort of redirecting these attacks. And a lot of the ones that they have fallen back on time after time when the tax issue has been brought up is Hillary Clinton's email scandal. And I think that is just a trend that we're going to see continue throughout the rest of the election. And I think it is something that's easy to point to because it's not really apples to apples. You know, they're very different things. The emails are different than his tax returns. And Hillary Clinton has already released her tax returns, so it's sort of, you know, one thing that the campaign can turn to as sort of a defense of him, you know, making this decision not to release.
Talking to Abigail Tracy from Vanity Fair, looking at latest news in the presidential race, Donald Trump's taxes, and a little more. You can call in, by the way. Is this tax information, Donald Trump's tax information, an important issue to you or a non-issue to you? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And another issue, does it matter to you who endorses a candidate, a presidential candidate, any candidate? Is there somebody you look forward to endorsing? 800-642-1234. And Abigail, I want to turn to another story you covered. Big endorsement in Ohio. LeBron James, basketball player. Now, that doesn't sound like maybe a big deal here in Wisconsin, but I try to come up with an analogy. Like if Aaron Rodgers of the Packers had grown up in Wisconsin, gone to high school, gone straight from high school to the Packers, left, come back, won a Super Bowl, that would be to Wisconsin what LeBron James is to Ohio, at a battleground state. Is this an important endorsement that we should be paying attention to?
Yeah, absolutely. I think right now, especially when we're looking at the popularity of the two candidates, which is historic, unprecedentedly low,
very low.
I think what you're seeing is celebrity endorsements do actually matter a lot in this race, especially with those undecided voters and people that they can sway. And when you're looking at a state like Ohio, which has traditionally been a bellwether state for presidential elections, it's important. You know, it is a battleground state, and it has 18 electoral votes, and it matters, and it will eventually matter in the outcome of the race. But what you're kind of seeing this year is Trump has sustained a pretty decent lead in the polls in Ohio for probably about since the midsummer. I think this morning, according to like an average, it was about 3.8 edge that he had over Clinton. But what you're kind of seeing is, you know, he needs to reach out to these other voters that have traditionally been going toward Clinton, especially in a state like Ohio, where it is incredibly crucial to whether or not he makes it to the White House.
Join in with your thoughts on the presidential race at 800-642-1234 as we talk to reporter Abigail Tracy about Trump's taxes, celebrity endorsements. Want to know if those make a difference to you? Again, call in at 800-642-1234.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation now with Abigail Tracy. You can see her work at VanityFair.com, looking at the latest from the campaign trail, talking about Donald Trump's federal tax returns, Hillary Clinton's endorsement in a battleground state. You can call in at 800-642-1234. Do Trump's taxes matter to you? Does a big name endorsement sway your vote in presidential or other elections? 800-642-1234 is the number. We'll go to Linda in Egg Harbor. Linda, hi.
Hi. I just want to make sure I heard this correctly. So in 1995, Trump put in for $960 million and therefore received the next 20 years tax-free.
He could have done, yes. Tax writers say he reported that amount of losses, and we haven't seen the tax returns for the following years, but people are saying, yeah, that he could have done that, yes.
Okay, he's just lost my vote. I'd say absolutely, if people don't look at this and say, we, the people, pay into the school systems, into everything that our taxes pay for, and this man has skipped out on it, you know, he just lost my vote, and if everyone follows his suit, I understand he said, I'm so smart, this was the smartest thing to do. If we all took the same route, we would be anything but great as a nation.
Linda, thanks for the call. And Abigail, that was a line of attack from Hillary Clinton, suggesting that Donald Trump might not be paying taxes, and saying voters would not be happy with that, wouldn't like that someone was not meeting that obligation.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think you will see some backlash to it.
Linda, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Charlie on the line in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thank you. I'm a conservative Republican who is finding myself considering voting for Hillary, if not for one simple fact, and that is she has yet to state how she would be more honest. She has repeatedly lied to us about her emails, and she also said that she is going to use in the White House people like her husband, who has been caught lying and perjuring himself and even losing his law license. On top of that, several big, important Clinton aides, Hillary aides, have repeatedly required immunity and taken the fifth, and they're questioning, how can we vote for someone who will not be honest? And that's my biggest question.
Charlie, thanks a lot for the call. And Abigail, Charlie saying Republican, he's got doubts about Donald Trump, but people have pointed toward reservations about Hillary Clinton, as Charlie's saying, over lack of transparency. So do you, people have made the case that, you know, basically both candidates want everybody talking about the other one and the other one's problems to distract from their own. Is that how you see this next 5 weeks shaping up?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of an unpopularity contest is the way a lot of people put it into context. And what you're seeing is you're seeing two of the most historically unpopular candidates in history. And what they do is they deflect. You know, neither has a squeaking clean record, and neither, you know, if you made a candidate in a lab, would probably be what you came out with. But when you're looking ahead, I guess my biggest advice to voters who are, you know, figuring out who to cast their ballot for this fall would be to look at the policies and look at the policies that you think will most likely improve your day-to-day life. I think, you know, neither candidate is perfect, and you're not going to be able to change that now with 6 weeks to go. So I think it really comes down to the policies that you support at the end of the day.
Charlie, thanks for that call. As we talked to Abigail Tracy from Vanity Fair, looking at the latest in the presidential race, Donald Trump's taxes, endorsements, and more, Megan joins us next in Milwaukee. Megan, hi.
Hi. So I have two comments. For LeBron James, I believe that that's extremely important for the millennial vote and the African-American vote in Ohio. And I believe that if Donald Trump, he's been running on that he'll fix the infrastructure in the country, that it's abysmal, it's a disaster, and that he will also hire more police for the violence in the cities like Detroit and Chicago. Well, if he's not paying taxes, then those two arguments of his are completely moot, because that's how we pay for things like police and infrastructure. So that would be my comment. Thank you.
Megan, thanks for the call. Abigail, let's look at that first comment. First, LeBron James, she says, will help get millennial votes. And that's an area where Hillary Clinton has been struggling as compared to Barack Obama, hasn't she?
Yeah, she definitely has. I think when you're looking at Hillary Clinton, she hasn't been able to energize the young voter base in the same way that we saw Obama do in 2008 and 2012, and it has hurt her. I think also, you know, if you look at the millennial generation, they grew up with her in the public eye, but it very much like kind of, you know, post-Clinton presidency, and you're seeing these different scandals play out in the media. So for a lot of millennials, they didn't necessarily know Hillary Clinton when she was, you know, working with children and minorities and kind of fighting these other causes that she says contribute so much to her platform. And I think, you know, that makes it hard for her to get these young voters to back her right now.
Thanks for that call. Time for a quick call from Dennis in Wautoma. Dennis, hi.
Hey there. Thanks for taking the call. I was just going to point out that, you know, the defenders of Trump are calling him a genius for taking advantage of the tax structure. But my comment is, what kind of a genius loses $1 billion back in the 90s when, I mean, let's face it, that was the best of all times. That was the dot-com miracle. Everything was going crazy. It wasn't until the crash that all that came to an end. So there were new millionaires popping up all over the place, new billionaires popping up all over the place. It was the wealthiest and the best of all times for the American economy, and here he is losing $1 billion.
Dennis, thanks for that call. And briefly, Abigail, you think that's an argument we're going to see going back and forth over the next few weeks?
Yeah, it definitely has been something that has been called into question throughout this election. I mean, you do look at his financial dealings and the number of times that he has declared bankruptcy, and while he gets up there and he boasts, you know, his business acumen and says that this is a reason why he is fit to run the country. And I think a lot of people do have hesitation with the fact that he has declared bankruptcy numerous times. And also, yes, he lost nearly $1 billion in 1995, according to this tax document that has recently come to light. So those are questions about, you know, how great of a businessman is he?
And we'll leave it there. That's Abigail Tracy from VanityFair.com. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Right now, we're taking a look at a program that was announced last week in Madison and could change how the city approaches drug addiction. The Madison Police Department received a $700,000 federal grant that will help pilot the Madison Addiction Recovery Initiative. The program would allow officers to offer treatment to low-level drug offenders instead of giving them jail time.
The grant from the U.S. Department of Justice is expected to fund the pilot program for 3 years. It would put low-level offenders with drug addictions into a system that would offer immediate treatment, the goal to offer a more permanent solution instead of repeated arrests of people with drug dependencies.
Joining us now to tell us more about this program is Mike Koval, Chief of Police for the Madison Police Department. Chief Koval, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, you've said that with this grant, you feel like for the first time in a long time, you can make a difference. What makes you say that?
Well, you know, it's just that I've spent over my entire adult professional life in this field, and I've just gotten so much to the point of being so frustrated with that the brick and mortar traditional criminal justice response to this has been wholly inadequate. It's so darn pricey, and at the end of the day, it really doesn't get anything towards the root causes of why people offend because of an addictive proclivity there. And in that sense, I think that we can offer a lot more at, I think, a better price point in the long run. Get to the core of addiction and understand that when someone is literally sick, as we see somebody in a typical modality of sickness prevention and otherwise, that I think you'll find that we don't have to criminalize these folks who have that problem.
So looking at that, the traditional approach until now has been to give someone maybe some jail time, a fee. Mm-hmm. So how do you see this changing? Can you lay out what the new plan would look like?
Well, sure. It actually means that the officers are sort of at a point of contact, point of treatment options. Certainly people are empowered to make their choices, but it's nice to be able to say that rather than going to the jail and getting your booking picture taken, that we can take you through a treatment methodology. And I think that will be infinitely better, and I'm hoping a lot of people go through that portal.
So a treatment methodology, so the officer sounds like will offer treatment as an option instead, and what happens next?
Well, once we make those identifications, we literally will be taking them then to an intake counselor who, working with providers who both represent residential and outpatient treatment, and also they'll be assigned a peer support recovery coach. So that'll provide immediate help as well as ongoing and continuing support during their treatment periods.
Do you get the sense that being able to intervene at this particular part in the process, there's been a low-level offense that involves someone who has a dependency on drugs, that this is maybe a crucial time in this person's life when they might be more willing to think about getting treatment?
I really do think so, because the fact of the matter is that when you are so tied inextricably to getting that next drug fix or whatever, this is the time when instead of punishing you and we're offering you a better option, a path of lesser resistance, and quite frankly, we're hoping that will also mean some cut down, frankly, in our property crimes that are being committed. So it does still have a gainful purpose for us, as well as, I think, from a community health standpoint, in that we're looking for a reduction in the rates of overdose and overdose-related deaths, which have been skyrocketing the last couple of years.
And you mentioned maybe a decrease in property crimes. What are some of the other goals of the program?
Well, of course, the first thing is that if we can have this partnership that really works well with providers, then I think then that the ultimate goal is that people will feel less resistance and can even do self-referrals. They don't even have to be on the precipice of committing a crime. If they know that there are these portals of entry through the conventional way, but even through their own police department, I'm hoping that we will see an improvement in public safety. It'll be improvement in community health. And we're hoping to get as high as up to 150, 160 participants on a yearly basis. That's our hope.
Now, is this a different role for officers at a time when they might normally be making arrests? Instead, they're channeling someone toward treatment. Do they have the training here?
Yes, and the officers will be very anxious to embrace this kind of a training because whether they be detectives who are assigned to a drug unit or officers who are constantly chasing these overdoses all over the city, I think we've all grown road weary of seeing this cyclical effect. And so many of these individuals, we have been administering naloxone 2, 3, 4 times in some instances. And so you really feel like you're stuck on this carousel ride that nobody can stop and nobody can get off. So to us, this looks like a very erstwhile kind of option for us. And I think that the officers will be eager to try this out on the street.
We're talking with Madison Police Department Chief right now, Mike Koval, joining us to talk about the Madison Addiction Recovery Initiative, a federal grant that would give treatment to nonviolent drug offenders instead of jail time. And you mentioned earlier that you think that this is actually going to save money along the way, too, aside from all the other things we've been talking about. How would that work?
Well, you know, so much of what we do when we do institutional care, meaning throwing people in jail, is extremely expensive. It doesn't, again, get to the actual treatment of people. It's just a maintenance sort of program. And so you're no better off, and frankly, it's pretty expensive. And I think that what we're hoping to see, and this will hopefully be borne out by the UW-Madison researchers, who will be literally looking at this for its cost effectiveness, is that it's a lot easier to provide more people outpatient treatment than inpatient treatment. So I think that there's going to be a lot of things to be looked at, and I think that one of the things is that there are a lot of erstwhile outpatient treatments that can be done, especially since we're going to be dedicating some money to peer support recovery coaches who can ensure that people are making their appointments and getting the help they need.
Now, as I understand it, the federal grant would not pay for the treatment itself, and it would not pay for a bed in a facility either. Do you consider either of those things hurdles that still need to be overcome for a lot of people?
Yes, I do. I don't think that we by any way have turned a corner on this, but at the end of the day, I still think that the alternative, something, is infinitely better than what's currently offered, which is very little to nothing. And so I tend to want to look at this as the glass is being half full, and we're going to get an impetus of help, hopefully from other partners in our community who will step up and see what kind of results this can have.
Has this kind of program had good results in other cities?
Well, I've always been envious because I first started seeing this being done by a chief of police in Gloucester, Massachusetts, a number of years ago, who had the luxury of telling his officers to drop those people who had overdosed directly off at a hospital or a treatment center. They had those kind of infrastructure resources that I was green with envy to read about. And we haven't had that same luxury here. But in a smaller scale, closer to home, preliminarily, we've seen some very promising results out of Seattle, and even Greenfield, Wisconsin started a little bit about this earlier this year.
And you know, Wisconsin has been hit especially hard by the opioid epidemic. How do you see this new program maybe having a positive, hopefully, impact on that?
Well, I'll tell you what. Your discussion about the devastating effects of it has certainly never been more self-evident when I look at my smartphone every 8 hours and see how many of these calls we go on. We're literally have risen to a point where it's sevenfold what we've seen since we started tracking this just 5 years ago. And obviously our officers are going through naloxone like you can't believe. So we're hoping that this will give us an impetus again to sort of see whether we can't turn a corner and reverse the scales of what the statistics have warranted to date.
And, you know, one thing that I noticed you've been thinking about is the families who are involved when we about people with addiction problems and how it's the families, children, spouses who suffer too. Are you hopeful that this program could have a positive impact there and help not just one person but entire families?
Oh, I do, because it's becoming increasingly difficult for us not to see someone in our circle of friends where heroin hasn't had an impact or some sort of opiate hasn't had an impact on someone we know and love and care about. And it's those secondary and tertiary victims that really break your heart as well, because they, too, are living this incredible roller coaster ride. And more often than not, we're seeing that with the heroin that's coming into Madison laced with fentanyl, our naloxone administration is becoming even sort of more and more needed, and yet it doesn't have the same the same potency. So we are having more people succumb to death, and seeing these families rocked asunder, such as it is by this, is really draws on your heartstrings. The letters that I've gotten would make you cry.
What kind of letters?
Well, I've had a gentleman who said basically that for those who think that those who are constantly using naloxone and take sort of a cynical Darwinian rule, he has related to me how the fact that one of our officers administered naloxone, that was a turning point. She had overdosed before, but in this instance, maybe it was her third time, this was nevertheless that point in which she was literally pulling herself up from the bootstraps, and they had the resources to move her out of state and get some help, and she's working jobs. And he reported to me about a year, it's been about a year since when we had our encounter with her, when she was literally pulseless and non-breathing. And so to see those sort of success stories from brinksmanship of death really makes you very, very gratified.
And you're hoping to see more of those,
exactly.
It sounds like. And another aspect of this plan we haven't touched on yet is it sounds like for some people, at a certain point, they could also have their record wiped clean. How would that work?
Well, again, this goes to the bigger part of CCAP and other things, but if we can avoid from having someone go through the booking process or to be charged with a crime at the outset, that means that you're not going to have a rap sheet or a record of arrests and prosecutions. And I obviously have some very strong feelings with what CCAP can do. It's sort of an insidious form of institutional racism for unscrupulous people because, you know, those who aren't ethical, landlords or potential employers, they look at CCAP at that arrest column and find all kinds of ways to disqualify people from participating in society. And so if we can avoid the stream of those people going to CCAP in the first place, that's also another positive win out of this.
And Chief Koval, just briefly before we let you go, when does this all get started?
Well, we hope to get it started in the first quarter of 2017 with our partners from Public Health and the University and also many others that there's a lot of things to coordinate and people to hire, but we're very anxious about getting it launched. So by early 2017, we should be able to report back to you on what it looks like.
Great. Well, Chief Koval, thank you so much for joining us, and we look forward to hearing more.
Thanks for getting this story out. We appreciate it.
That was Mike Koval, Chief of Police for the Madison Police Department. And he joined us there to talk about the Madison Addiction Recovery Initiative, federal grant money that would give treatment to nonviolent drug offenders instead of giving them jail time.